Welcome to the fourth episode of Africa's LSP podcast, your premier podcast for the language services industry in Africa. In this episode of the podcast, we are going to have a very interesting conversation with Inzoki Richard, a translator based in Uganda. Welcome to the fourth episode of Africa's LSP podcast. Today with us, we have Mr. Inzoki Richard from Uganda. He is a professional translator, and he's going to share with us some aspects about local language translation and local languages in general in Uganda. We know that Africa has about 2,000 languages, and so sometimes we have to ponder over the significance of African languages within the language services industry. Inzoki, you're welcome to Africa's LSP podcast.
Thank you, Adi. Good to be here and talk to you and talk to the world.
Can you please introduce yourself? Tell us a bit about what you do, especially when it comes to language services.
Richard Inzoki in Uganda. I trained in doing linguistics and translation, and I've been doing that for the past 15 or so years. My bachelor's training was something else, so I switched somewhere in between, and I took a master's degree training in translation studies. At that time, I was particularly preparing to do translation of the scriptures of the Bible in my mother tongue, through a missionary-assisted translation project. And that's been the journey since then. So I've done a bit of translation of the Bible. And later, after about 5 years of being part of the translation team of the Bible in my mother tongue, I switched role to concentrating more of doing linguistic research, analysis, in a bid to prepare what I would call foundational tools that facilitate the writing and the reading and the learning to read of local languages in Africa. My focus has been Uganda especially, but I've also had a little exposure supporting language communities outside of Uganda, basically around and about neighboring countries like Sudan and Tanzania. In addition to the translation work that I do and involvement in language development, I also oversee a training program targeting the African continent with a theme of developing capacity within Africa for Africa in the development and the translation work that we have. This is something that missionaries have over the ages come and supported Africa. And the time came that Africa needs to carry its own cross and have ways and the right people to do work for themselves. So I serve as the course director for a program that is SIO founded called iDelta. iDelta is the Institute for the Development of Literacy and Translation in Africa. We run training programs for the Anglo-Lusophone side of Africa and the Francophone. So I'm in charge of the Anglophone side as a course director. And the trainings happen in Uganda once a year for a period of 2 months, where we receive people from all over Africa to come and train for those specialties, either in translation or in there's another track we call scripture engagement, or local language engagement, actually, where you get the tools that you have, the information that you have, and transfer it into materials that are usable in the pockets, in the minds, in the hands of the people. Could be audio, could be video, could be print, could be in form of story, like where you get language and language knowledge and cut it into small bits and pieces that people can use for apply to their real life situations. And the other track that you're training is literacy and multilingual education, where we train people who can design literacy programs in teaching the reading and writing of the local languages for Africa. So they could be actually teachers in formal training programs like schools, or in informal training programs, maybe like adult literacy classes at informal settings at church, in a community, or in the streets. And we help them to learn the skills of how to do that. We also train them in how to develop materials, instructional materials, even curricula on how to deliver on a literacy program in a local language, or in both in the monolingual and the bilingual and multilingual situation, and also how to design, how to assess a literacy program. We do training for that as well. The other track we do is linguistics training, basic linguistics in applied sense, not your theory. How do you get your phonetics knowledge, phonology knowledge, to do an actual language analysis that you can develop an alphabet for a community that is struggling? They want to write their language, but they don't know how to. Or could be that they have a writing system, but they don't understand why it is not working, because either it's difficult or incomplete. So we support that. Even developing dictionaries, dictionary making, we train people to do that in this program. And we are focusing on Africa, African languages, so that we can serve Africa as Africans.
That's fantastic. It really shows that you've done a lot of work when it comes to local languages. Tell us a bit about the local language landscape in terms of what languages are the most spoken, what languages are mostly used in publications.
Uganda is, a country where English seems to be everything. There is a lot of English around. Because it's a national language, it's an official language, it's the language of education. Although between the years there's been a flip-flopping between supporting or opening up for developing some local languages to be used in school, but mainly as a bridge to learning English. So we have a landscape where in every corner of the country, you either start school straight away from English, from kindergarten up to university, or you start with a given local language, maybe through the first two or three levels, then you have to transition to English. So English is really pumped down our throat very, very hard because it's a language of business and education and more or less survival. However, I would say that in the last decade, there's been quite a shift, not a shift overturning things, but to try to promote the development of the native languages, some that can, and have the infrastructure to be used perhaps at more or less equal level or as much as it can shoot. So the stigma, even the perception and the acceptance of using local language, even in formal domains, has been picking up with time. It's been quite a struggle, especially when you have a fraternity that thinks, they have been used to doing things a certain way, and then they have to learn this. And, there is this tendency that people think, because I am born this, I've been speaking this since I was a child, I know the language. But you know that for a language to be committed in formal domains of use, in literature, in education, in science, it also needs to have the basic tools like a writing system, like supporting literature, like dictionaries and the thesauruses, which people had never taken time to think of or write up or even study, like learning the grammar of your own language so that you can manipulate it comfortably in writing, in teaching, in assessment of things and committing knowledge to it. It just wasn't the case. So yes, when you say we're going to use local languages, say in education, as media of instruction, that's a reaction when people are too used to writing in English, spelling in English, commenting in English, assessing in English. They'll say, oh no, now that is so difficult. How can we deliver a lesson in the mother tongue? How can I do a sermon, a preaching in the local language? Because you need to write it now. Well, as for jokes, for casual talk outside the streets, people are comfortable. But when it comes to formal, like I would say, literate communication, where you have to read, or you have to write what is read. I mean, what you have to read what is written, or you have to write, commit your thoughts into writing so that somebody else can read them from her. Yeah, it's been a challenge. And that's been the hurdle for the last 10 years. The acceptance that you can actually do so much using your local language.
So that's very true. I think in other African countries, so I can speak for Ghana, for instance, they also, there's also the teaching of some local languages. I think the government sponsors 11 local languages, and these are taught in schools. So it's a very great initiative. And apparently in Uganda, the inclusion of mother tongue education was started in 2004, if I'm not mistaken. Did you take part in that process at that time, or you joined in later?
I would actually say it was I think the idea was accepted, floated, and endorsed by the powers that be in 2004. But the actual implementation started in 2007 with a pilot program taking care of 12 languages. So we're only a few more than what happens in Ghana. And I was part of that process, yes.
That's great. So we want to know a bit about the entire process, because introducing local languages into a curriculum, I think that might be a bit challenging. How was the entire process like in terms of the various processes that they used, and in terms of technology, did they use any CAD tools or any other systems that could help them to manage technology and other factors?
I would appreciate that there was a lot of commitment from the policymakers and the government to try with this path, because it wasn't the first time. It had actually been around the country some years back, slightly post-independence, and through the 80s, then like things went haywire. All of a sudden, there was a shift back to English. And you could actually see that the foundation, the educational foundation that had been established by the people who went through an education system prior, I mean, those days when the like local language was used very much in school up to quite higher levels of education, there were people you would meet and you know this one went to school, this one is learning, this one is studied. They were people of substance, yeah, kind of. So that report and the recommendation came in the backdrop of the fact that they were seeing that there's much benefit in setting a foundation for literacy in a language that people already are familiar with, comfortable with, so that it cuts down on the burden of a growing literate society. Now, when it comes back, I would also say that much as it was good, there was a lot of overriding assumptions that made things being taken for granted. What happens is when they launch, a lot of effort was put in translating curricula, getting the basic teaching tools into the local language and designing the lessons, but little had been done in developing the necessary literature, the other literature that supports literacy, that supports reading, that supports writing, that is outside of the teacher-child classroom interaction, I mean blackboard. So yes, the government put in a lot in putting together the tools that the teacher would need to prepare a lesson, and the task that the child will do in class, and what will be put up on the blackboard, on the whiteboard for class interaction. But then outside that, there had been so little. And also the tools that the teacher would need outside of the classroom to expand their capacity for resources to draw from in preparing what they need to prepare, like growing their knowledge. For example, a dictionary is a very basic tool. Other literature, because if the teacher needs to give a story to the children in class, they need to have that story from somewhere. Either they can invent and somebody like invented the story and wrote it up, or you could take it from the general body of knowledge that you have around. Could be from the print media that you have, maybe from a local newspaper, but we didn't have such. There were barely any dictionaries in the country for each language. There's basically any body of literature that you could refer to for supplementary reading. And there'll be not even the media or the newspapers will be mostly in English, except I think one in Uganda, which is the biggest local language here. So if you have 12 languages running, and actually some of them didn't even have a standard writing system, an orthography, the set of spelling rules, or a complete set of alphabets, like which is adequate and representative enough for the language. So there's been a lot of floundering in between and learning along the process. But as we grow in Africa, I think the beginnings are always hard. We know and we're used to that. We really learn to survive. We learn to steady up as we learn to walk. And it's been okay. Over time now, I would say things are getting much and much better. And there is growing acceptance and stability is taking shape.
Are you saying that things are getting better in terms of them having more materials?
Yes. Acceptance is growing. There have been people who have taken interest in writing in their local language, writing for their local communities, voluntarily. There are also who have come out to do commercial with a target. And plus, communities generally accepting that actually that local language is a beautiful, wonderful media to use for a certain effect that you would never get easily or as widely as if you use the foreign language. And that cuts across outside of education. For example, the church, which is, I would say, one of the organized bodies, institutions in the country or in the world, has accepted that actually, if you do talk to people, if you do give them literature in the local language, you have mileage that you'd never in English, because you also compare it against the literacy levels. People don't need to go to school to understand what you're talking to them in their local language. They only need to go to school to know how to write it or how to decode the symbols that you use, because writing is also formulaic. But if you spoke to them, they understand. But English, you got to do everything from zero, getting the concepts, getting how to put them together, then making the right interpretation of them, and then figuring out the semantic ranges of things. So there is a lot of learning before of the non-native language, before you can, like you'd say, the decoding of meaning will come home straight away. So church, business, people, generally the general public has come to accept that with the local language, you can go far. So we have a lot of media now publishing in the local language compared to then. We have print and the broadcast. We have music. The industry has really grown so much. People composing songs and doing very well, plus other entertainment media. So is school, so is church, like I said, in the religious domain. Like people have now come to appreciate communication and delivery of messages through local language. But even in health, I don't know what program succeeds there if you don't get materials in local language, because now the message comes much clearer to the people. Whatever campaign is malaria, or you're talking about like now COVID, like if you walked around the streets within the urban centers, yes, you see all this literature, these posters and warning signs and directions about maybe warning about COVID in English. But in the villages, I think people are favoring local language because it speaks louder in the hearts of people. Yeah. The message sinks faster, easier. So that is the impact that it has come with. Yeah,
yeah, just as Nelson Mandela said, right? Like if you speak to people in their own language, it actually resonates with them very deeply.
Sure.
And in view of all that you said about how local languages are expanding and everything, what has been an impact on translation into local languages, not only within Uganda, but also globally? Has there been an increase in demand for translation into local languages, and particularly for professionals like you to actually handle these translations?
Absolutely, yes. I did say that I did active translation for a project to the magnitude of the Bible. A portion of the Bible, we're doing the New Testament some years back. But the need did drive me a bit to instead support the preparatory stages for translation work. That is researching languages to establish maybe verity and vitality, but also developing writing systems and then developing dictionaries. So that has been my concentration for some time. But in between, I am pulled off because there are always translation needs popping up from every other corner. And they need attention, yeah. That is not only for scriptures, but also for educational materials, for evangelism, and quite a lot. I've been involved in several projects off the hook, for policy, for legal and health, I mean, projects, because even community empowerment, civil rights, could be dealing with simple things like economic, socioeconomic projects. There's a lot of need that I know. And I have a plethora of projects that I've been involved in that cut across all domains of knowledge and domains of need, I would say. So yes, yes, and yes. If someone was in this country, maybe say 15 years ago, and just looked, maybe would see the advertising industry then and came back today, they might struggle to make sense of a lot of the billboards and the print and non-print media we have out in the public, because there's been a significant shift to the local language, I would say. A lot of advertisements and signage around the shops and even off the screens in the houses, on TV, a lot of local language content coming up because it's giving them mileage, I would say, again.
All right, so you spoke about translating into the local language, translating the Bible into the local language. And we know how missionaries played a key part in the history of translation. And I'd be interested to know actually the process that was followed in carrying out this project and what languages were the focus.
I have been involved with translation through, I would say, a missionary supported initiative through SIL International. You probably may have heard of that or not, because I'm sure they operate in Ghana. However, the philosophy has been and still is that missionaries don't come to do translation. They have favored bringing in whatever resource they may have to the community that needs, where they establish a need for translation for scriptures. Then they develop the capacity of the native people, the speakers, people they find to have the basic qualifications to access higher training into translation and linguistics and literacy and other necessary skill sets. And they have the natives do that. So for all the projects that I know of that I've been involved in and I know are happening around, not right now, not only through the entity that I am affiliated with, but also other translation, Bible translation agencies projects in the country, the natives, the locals are the lead translators. The experts, either within or outside, from outside, only come in to give accuracy checks. And these are people who can do that from the benefit of the resources that we have available to anyone else from the profession. So they don't need to know the local language to be able to say that actually your translation is spot on in this area or it's missing this idea. But they don't check naturalness. They don't check clarity, because then we go through other stages. So a typical translation process for Bible, which actually to me applies to all translation, if I didn't translation, I'd take it through some stages, is we consider the accuracy, that is the meaning correspondences from the original to the new one, because our philosophy is a meaning-based approach. We respect less of the form of the original and value a lot. I mean, you take in the utmost respect the meaning. So we struggle so much to figure out what is the original intention of the author or the speaker or the, and then what was the intention towards the audience, and how do we carry that and dress it up in this new form that local language dictates. It could be changing around vocabulary, structure, could be adding in a little more, making explicit what would otherwise be missed if we don't. It would be barring under, like making, putting, making implied what otherwise the original has explicit, if it's culturally appropriate this way, so that we don't interrupt the transfer of the meaning. So accuracy is very critical, and we have an accuracy process. In Bible, they call it an exegesis, that is a study of the original meaning, then see how you transfer that. When we do that, so that one, the translator has the burden of pursuing that, and you access all the resources you can. For Bible, for example, there's a lot of translation notes per book. There's a lot of, we study Greek. We get to learn Greek and Hebrew because I would say the most organized set of scriptures that have lived through the centuries were first committed into Greek for the New Testament and Hebrew for the Old. So I learned Greek myself, and I have colleagues who have studied Hebrew to be able to capture the accuracy aspects of the work. Then there's a plethora of translation notes, a lot of commentaries. So we have a lot of literatures, which of late, thanks to technology, has been condensed into resources that we can find off one app. We have tools like Translators Workplace that we use for Bible that has a lot of resources packed in there. Maybe resources that like support particular interpretations, Agnes another. Resources that come from the different scripts and original or claimed original materials, some of which are just still being discovered for those, the archaeologists are still doing work. Then any other thing. So technology is very key in terms of supporting translation, very, very key. We depend a lot on it. We no longer do manual stuff for translation, really. We have a lot of apps that support that, about 3 or 4, and we keep upgrading them with every other change that comes. Then when we do the accuracy mapping, we have to come to the naturalness. So the me, who is a translator, but also learned, educated, and exposed, and know how to use the resources, I know the translation principles, I have to come back to the core of being the native speaker of my language, for example, because we use native speakers of the language to translate. So I also draw a lot on my encyclopedic awareness of my language and where I struggle. We have resources like dictionary. In our program, part of the translation preparation phases is we develop a dictionary. So we have to collect the vocabulary and put definitions to it so that it's a resource that translators sit with next to them on the table to refer to. And then as a place of first resort. But then also translation teams work with what we call a translation review committee. So within the language area, we challenge the community, the leaders of the community to mobilize among themselves a committee of who they think are knowledgeable men in matters of culture and language, either because they are known to be very knowledgeable from history or connection, or they've studied it, or because of their age or their whatever area of notch they have in the cultural, ethno-cultural constitution of their community. Those are recommended to a committee, and those people go through, they listen to every translation that we do, every portion. Like for every portion, say, if you do a chapter 2 or 3, you submit to them and you go and present and talk about it. They read through and they give you feedback. So they will give you the naturalness and the clarity checks. They'll say, no, we don't say like that. Or this word is vulgar. oh, when you say this, you can mean this and that, and now we don't know which one of those meetings you mean, kind of. So they also trained, we train them in their role, that they know what to look out for, and they give that feedback. So that is the stage two. And the stage three is, we call it a community check. This is a review committee check. Now, the third one is community. After it's gone through them, we do ad hoc checks on the portions of translation that we've done. I print out a page, for example, or two or three, or a whole book. And I can do this even for any other translation I do. For example, if I'm translating a storybook written by somebody, I can take one chapter of it. And I go out and gather boys around the football pitch, or maybe a small women group at church, wherever it is, or just outside, even at a drinking place. You know, Africa, we like fellowshipping in the evenings at around those social places, gatherings, where people just do their leisure. When you go to them then say, guys, as they sip away at their alcohol, you say, I want to read your story. They are happy to be entertained by you. So they listen to you talking. I mean, you read it out of the paper and you hear what they think or what they say. Where necessary, you can even pose a few questions, what we call the comprehension questions, about areas where you are also not sure that there could be points of potential ambiguity. So you pause, and the responses they give you will tell you whether they actually missed it or they got it clear. So that is the final stage. And the last stage is we have that consultant check. Yeah, a professional, somebody of caliber, somebody of high experience, both in training and actual involvement in the work, goes through with you as translators to pick any other small, untidy notes that are still hanging. And now, with the consultant, who doesn't necessarily have to be a native, mostly if they're not, they access the content through what we call a back translation. You must be familiar with this. We get our translations and give it to somebody else who was not part of the translation team. And we ask that person to write, to translate back from the local language into English without looking at any other resource. Like, what they see is what they read and make sense of, and write the English equivalent of what they think it is. Then that back translation is passed on to the consultant way before they come. Could be a month or weeks. Then they go through it and compare with the other resources they have, maybe from the Greek, from the English, or from other translations they are familiar with, and correspond to see if we're speaking just about the same thing. Kind of. So when he notes any areas of ambiguity, of skipping, of gaps, of confusion, they come to the translation session, checking session, which are normally face-to-face, like we have a gathering of people, and they go through verse for verse, sentence by sentence, to make sure that we understand each other clearly. And that will be the last phase in the kitchen before we can commit to a printout in a public, that for, as a publication, to distribute to the community, to the people, the users. And we give it a period of 3 years. Like when we publish a book, a portion or an entire Bible, we give it a period of 3 years, because this applies only for Bible, because it's a very sensitive document. We give it like a period of 3 years to attend to any feedback, any comments, any reactions from the user community. What do you think? Before we can now do the final nice print binding, golden ring, something like that. Yeah, leather cover piece of literature, in case there are any mistakes, typos, and wrong vocabulary. That's what happens with Bible. Now, when I do other translations, when I get involved in other translations, we don't necessarily go as thorough as that, but we take the principles out of it. For example, checking with what we call a non-involved user, reader of the text. Like, you go out and find somebody who can volunteer to look through your work, and they give you some feedback. So you know that at least I've tried to communicate and there's some ambiguity before I return work to you. If you give me work to translate for you. I would check it with myself and with my team, that, and also go out and check with somebody outside of us, so that I'm confident.
Wow, that's a really extensive process, especially for the Bible. So, back on technology, how do you think the integration of our local languages with, for instance, computer softwares has been so far, especially with Ugandan local languages? Is it easy, for instance, if someone wants to use Google Translate to get Luganda, for instance, since it's the most spoken?
I don't know how much would have achieved without technology. Unfortunately, it's not like everywhere. Maybe I would say the translation fraternity here is not so big. We are in, I would comfortably say we are in the infant stages. I know people have been translating for years and generations, but this is one in 1,000. And far in between and across generations. So we would really not say that it's a crowded market that is very competitive and pursuing cutting edge ways of doing things. Now, I come into discussion from a background of my involvement with a very highly sophisticated, highly informed, highly involved language development organization, SILEs. So technology has been part and parcel of my initiation into the process. The time I started translation, we had even a tool that we would use for adapting. Like if you had a language that is very closely related to another, and that one has already a literature, I mean a translation, we could adapt a text into a software, and then we run it through a machine called Adapt, I mean a software tool called Adapt It, and it will give you what we call it, like maybe call it a zero draft. And like my language and Luganda are not very far apart, so we did do some books by adapting the Luganda text, ran through that software, and it will give us some, I would say, 40% close text, which would run through and change a few prefixes and suffixes there, or a few symbols in between. Then you have something zero to begin with, than if you just begin from scratch, inputting text from the blue. And over time, and that is translation. These days, there is even more sophisticated software. I have been involved with working on dictionaries, and we have data or word list elicitation software, a lot of it, that you just sit and it gives you a range of words and you get equivalents. It can sort out for you very easy. In 3 months, I can have as close as 10,000 words, all sorted nicely and with all the different definitions and markers put on. And that is not just that, plus other tools. So technology has been helping a lot. These days, we even produce small booklets. We have software that can really ease the process of making a library. We have shell books where you have the pictures already input, the format's already done, and just do translation of a few sentences in there or three, and you have a book and going to a publisher in just weeks. So software has been helping, but like I said, there are not many places you find that, and that is partly because there are not so many people doing translation. And the few who are doing, I think Endeavor, very few are still doing manual things, like doing handwritten or type, then you type it out. Many are really adopting technology. So Google Translator, for example, has Luganda on it. I don't know. Yes, they have another language called, it's called Runyachitara, but actually Runyachitara is a mixture of four dialects. And I think it's just because they are mutually intelligible. So whatever you put in to give you something equivalent to either of the four, kind of. Not as perfect as Luganda would be the near equivalent. But there's no other language that we have on within here that I think is close to that. Well, apart from Nyachara and Luo, but not as perfect as Luganda. And even Luganda is not as close to, the Kiswahili type, who are the giants in the region.
That's good to hear. I mean, it's really interesting to know that technology has been a key part of your work, even with local languages. And let's talk briefly about Swahili. We know how Swahili is the lingua franca in East Africa. How widely is it spoken or used in Uganda?
Not so much. I need to be honest. I mean, if you came by speaking Swahili, no one will look at you as a stranger. A few people will maybe envy you, like, oh, you are, you know, I speak Swahili, but just for that, as when you go away, no one will crave learning Swahili, and no one thinks they can't, they are being held back to acceding, accessing many opportunities because of Swahili. There's a history to that. The current political trends of integration have only recently revived the desire in a few people to pick up on Swahili and have facility with it. But if you go down the villages in the common person, average person on the streets, it's not really so much a priority.
Okay, so as we wrap up, this has been a very, very interesting conversation. I want to know what you think about the role of translators in promoting African languages, because as we said earlier, it's very important to actually speak to people in their own languages, produce content in their own languages, and we know how a lot of Africans are very much attached to their native languages. So what role can translators play or language service providers play in actually promoting African languages?
Well, what can I say? I have this feeling that, I mean, that is shared by almost everyone else, that we are in an era of knowledge explosion. There is a lot of knowledge gathered already about things. The only limitation is, could be 99% of that information is committed into language that is not like the password, the unlocking key to the people down there who need to benefit from it. So if, and that's why I see translators coming in. If you took time inventing things, what you call reinventing the wheel, we will never get there. There is a lot of information already around. If translators, if we would have translators who have the time, the commitment, they don't need to go looking for what to translate. So I think we would want to invest so much interest and time in how we can get this too much knowledge circulating around into bytes that are accessible to those people we talked about. They love their languages, but they also need this information. I come from a village where each time I visit the place, there are so many things that people are dealing with. And I know that there's a lot of other better ways of dealing with the same problem, if only these people would know. But if I could send a message, or if I would print a pamphlet and check to them, it would be in English and they can't get it. And I don't have the time to be there to explain everything, because then you read the English and then you interpret and then you demonstrate. So I see translation as a bridge. And I think the bridge that we need the most at the moment, because there's a lot of knowledge, there's a lot of information packaged in English, in French, and many other languages. And if we can break it down to the local languages, the native languages, then we will be growing a more conscious, a more aware generation that we live in. And that will be a great contribution that only translators can do.
I believe so too. The last point is really a deep one, that there's already a lot of information around that we can actually turn into various pieces of information in various forms to actually make sure that everyone is able to understand and improve how they go about things. So we really appreciate having you on the podcast, Mr. Nzogi Richard. It's been such a great conversation. And if you have any final words, observations, comments, you could let us know.
Oh yes, I know. I'm speaking to people who sleep where I sleep and who live where I live. In the language, I mean, the world of language development. I would really encourage that whoever has an opportunity to use it to try to demystify this animal called local language. I don't speak a local language. I speak a language. I think it's only local because I speak it with the people from a certain local certain place somewhere. However, for me to know, I mean, to use my language well as a tool, as a vehicle for delivering success, for delivering development, for transferring knowledge, for packaging secrets and passing them on to where they need to go, for bringing awareness, for bringing whatever it is that I want, like I would in English, we need to help our people to know that there is a structure in that language, there is a system within which that language operates, and we need to figure it out, understand it, then we can use it better. It's like when you drive a vehicle, when you don't know what it is, at least you need to know where the wheels are and why the wheels roll the way they do. And there's a lot of emphasis on developing local languages in Africa, using them for better, for politics, for science, for education, for whatever, for religious, whatever, for socioeconomic emancipation, even a self-identity. However, we sometimes tend not to think that we need to also invest time and resources in learning how these languages are structured, what their system is, so that we can understand. I always laugh at my colleagues because I've taken years even putting in money to learn the English language. I've paid tuition in school. I have been on tenterhooks for passing an exam because if I fail, then I'll repeat or I'll retake a course and because of the English. But how much do we actually study and learn the African languages so that we can use them for successful engagement in the future? So that is my last appeal. I'm like, let's encourage our people to actually invest in developing the learning of the languages so that we can shape them into tools that are usable, that are formidable, and to take us very far.
Thank you so much. And we hope to have you again for another session of the podcast.
I appreciate this opportunity to Adi, and I look forward to that again.